We're getting towards the last week of winter. In the week ahead of us, we've got the first week of spring. I thought before we leave winter behind us, last podcast we were looking at some of the winter flowers, and it's always quite surprising what's about. And some of them are not really very conspicuous unless you know where to look. So this morning there was rain forecast, and we're standing beside one of our British native trees, one of my absolute favourites, and it's the yew. And it comes into flower, believe it or not, at this time of the year. But yew is rather unusual because you have male trees and you have female trees. So it's a little bit difficult. Some of our other evergreen shrubs and plants, things like mistletoe, you'll have male and female mistletoe plants, and holly is the same. You'll have a male holly tree that produces pollen and the female holly tree which produces those lovely bright red berries. But the yew is quite amazing. It's one of our British natives, I said, here since before the last ice age, really. And I'm just going to demonstrate something to show how it comes into flower. I've just got a branch here, and I tap it. We can just see the pollen coming off. And the whole branches are covered with white pollen, and so are some of the leaves. It's a really venerable old tree. It probably... some of our oldest trees in the United Kingdom are yew, and they're often associated in churchyards. But sometimes, if you go back in history, the yew trees in the churchyards, 1,000 or more years old, are older than the churches themselves. So we think yews were often worshipped by sort of pre-Christian, the Druids, in other words, and then because it became a religious site associated with the Druids, often churches were built. And even today, although the trees are much younger that you see in churchyards today, you'll see many churchyards have yew in there because it's meant to soak up the evil from anybody in their graves. So it's a little bit of a sinister tree because when you look at them, they're really quite dark and sort of forbidding, really. Lots and lots of branches. This one that we're standing in is about 20 feet high, and I planted that in 1973. So plant a tree in 73, and I did lots of that. But the little needles in between them, the male pollen bearing parts, are absolutely laden with pollen, and on warm days, if you get a breeze coming through, even as we're right at the end of winter, in early to mid-February, the pollen is shed and it goes off in any which direction.
Do these become arils?
No. Right, turn around, Matthew. That is what you call a yew tree.
Oh, right, yes. That's a little bit more established, that
it's
one.
It's 60 feet tall, and it was planted at the same time High Ash Farmhouse, where I was born in, was built. So it's 1857, so it's over 100 years old, that tree. And it can get to 1,000 years. It depends on our climate. That's gone rather tall, and we're having more and more sort of intense wind events.
And when I talk about arils, those little red-coloured things, right, that appear later in the year, don't they?
Yes, right.
So they're not flowers?
No, absolutely not. That's the flowering part of the tree, and this yew tree is a female. And so this is the tree that bears the fruit that you're talking about, and the female parts are almost inconspicuous. Right, I can just reach up and get the first branch. Oop, little jump. Now, if we look carefully underneath, you'll see, there they are, these tiny little greenish-yellow buds on the underside of the leaves, protected, and they are accepting the pollen at the moment from that male tree. So they get pollinated.
So that dust you were talking about.
That what you call dust is pollen, yes.
Yeah, the dust-like.
Yeah. Dust-like. And you remember last week we looked at the hazel, which produces its pollen before the hazel comes into leaf with these... And this is a conifer, remember? Even the early sort of botanists classified yew trees as a completely different species, but they've realised subsequently that the arils that you talk about are actually hugely modified pine cones. And when you look at them in about July, when these little fertilised female portions are developing, they look rather like an acorn. And the little bit surrounding the acorn, in other words, the cup of what we would call the acorn, gradually turns pink and then deep, deep red. And it's a huge favourite amongst birds. So during the winter months, during November, the early part of the winter, November and December, this tree is covered in redwing, fieldfares, missel thrush, song thrush and blackbirds. They all absolutely love it. Now, the other surprising thing about yew is... not you personally.
There's nothing surprising about me.
Is that every part of the yew tree is poisonous. The roots are poisonous. They've all got a toxic chemical in them. The bark, the trunk itself, certainly the leaves, the twigs are all poisonous. And the chemical is called taxine, and it is really, really dangerous to livestock. So that is one of the reasons, and it's a smile on my face, that during the Enclosures Act, that a lot of vicarages planted yew trees in the churchyards to stop farmers grazing around the gravestones. Is quite clever, because if you put your sheep in there, or a horse, horses are particularly vulnerable to yew, and it's fatal for them. So that's a good way, without having to do the trouble of fencing in your churchyard, of keeping farmers out. So that the farmers would do the fencing. So there we are. It's getting pollinated at the moment, and if we came back in November, these bright red arils which surround the seed. Now, the arils are the only part of the yew tree that isn't poisonous, those juicy bright red surrounding, and inside that's a seed. The birds eat the arils and the seed in the middle of it, and it's a really hard seed. It goes through the alimentary canal of the bird and comes out as a dropping, but that's how yew kind of gets itself out and about in the countryside. So you drop on, and it's a huge shade loving tree as well. But you can see underneath this tree the ground's completely bare, nothing really grows under them because the shade is so intense,
and it's year round,
and it's year round shade. And there's some of the seeds that are on the ground, because the birds pecked the berries off, and sometimes the arils dropped on the ground, they'd get eaten, but they left a seed behind. And if you came back here in a week or two, you would see thousands of baby yew trees. They're not really very good at establishing themselves in the wild, but nevertheless they do. And I'm just looking down to see if I could see any. There's one. There you are.
Oh yes.
Look, two shoots
coming up.
Yes, two. And you can see the little leaves there, only about an inch tall.
But they won't survive.
Probably not. Another one there, look. But you could dig them out and put them into dense woodland, and that's their favourite habitat. And I've got some beautiful avenues underneath the beech trees on the farm, on the other side of the farm. They like kind of chalky soil as well, with high lime content. And it's one of the biggest embarrassments of my life, because I was walking through the avenues of beech with my first girlfriend, and we're coming up to the yew trees, and I just looked up really very casually, and I said, "Oh, I love you." And she flung her arms around me and gave me the biggest hug that I've ever had. And I was totally amazed. And then she said, "I never thought you'd say that." She said, and of course I meant I love you, not I love you. And as a result, she gave me a fridge magnet, never to let me forget. And it's made out of yew wood. And on it, it says, "I love you," spelt Y-E-W. How embarrassing is that?
I've got to say, that does sound typically you, that does.
Oh, thank you.
The birds are singing as well. It must be spring.
Yes, it's a delight. We've got more rain forecast, so February, which we've left behind us, has been one of the wettest on record, and we've got valleys here at the farm, and on five or six occasions this year the valleys have been flooded and turned into the Lake District almost, which amuses me. And then the water permeates it. Buzzard right in front of us, Matthew.
Great big wings flapping, yes. Just clearing the hedge there. Yeah,
just over the top of the hedge, and we've had a pair of red kite here this morning, about 7 o'clock this morning, just at first light, and they were courtship flying. It was a lovely sight. They were weaving round each other. Beautiful birds, both of them, very mature, and with that very distinctive forked tail. We're standing on one of the margins here at the farm. There's an arable field on our left with overwinter wild bird seed mix there, and there's teasels on the margin. Some blackthorn has spread itself out. You can see all these little twigs well away from the hedge, which was planted in 2007. That's getting going nicely. And blackthorn, Prunus spinosa, the spiny plum, is noted for suckering. It goes under the ground and then pops up at some distance. And if this was left, this would be a giant shrubbery. Very quickly indeed, and impenetrable. So we'll keep the margin cut every third year. And it's been sown with some coarse grasses, a mixture of a really coarse grass called Coxfoot and another one called Giant Fescue. And every morning I walk down here and throw some seed out, which you can just see on the ground there. And I've brought you here for a reason. Although we're looking at wildflowers, I'm easily distracted because I walked down here this morning and I thought it's a brilliant time of year to look for some of signs of our mammals as well. And we've got a little muddy track down here and lots of deer footprints.
Oh, these holes footprints?
Yes, these are called slots. And we've got two species, because you can identify your deer by the size of the slots. Occasionally we have giant ones here, which are red deer. And this is a monkjack deer, quite small, petite, two very distinctive little cloven hooves into the ground, and here's a much larger one a little bit further
on.
That's
made quite a divot there, hasn't it?
And that's a roe deer, one of our native species.
Oh, the ones we saw last week.
That's right, yes. Beautiful, beautiful roe deer. And there's some droppings there as well from perhaps the monkjack. They almost look like rabbit droppings. But that's not what caught my eye this morning, because this is a time of the year I look out for signs of last year's nests. And just turn round behind, because I think, yes, look down there. Can you see anything unusual?
No, it's just grass and
tall stems.
Oh, hang on.
Yes.
It looks like there's a nest of some sort.
Yep, well done.
About
well
6 spotted. Inches off the ground.
Yes, a good 6 inches off the ground, and it's the nest of one of our smallest, well, almost one of the smallest rodents in the whole world, Micromus minutis. It's the harvest mouse. And it's the time of year to find out if you've got harvest mice in your margins. And what you do, you walk along, make sure no neighbouring farmers are watching. You look down at the ground, just pretend you're very depressed as a farmer, but actually you're looking for harvest mice net. And you look down into the clump of grass, and it's a clump forming grass, and already there's a lot of new growth. And this particular grass species here is called giant fescue. I used to do this as a child. You'd pick a leaf out, they're very coarse, and there's veins all the way down the leaf, and you can put your fingernail in and shred the little veins out like that, and then you can peel back. Can you see? And that's what the female harvest mice does. Two sorts of nests they make. One quite close to the ground, which the male and female will occupy, and it's just a loose structure. And then the kind of world famous nest, harvest mouse, is about, what, 5 centimetres long body, and the tail is almost an equal length, and it's like a fifth leg. It's prehensile, so they can wrap their tail around these tall grass stems and hold on, pull another stem towards it, or if there's a wheat ear on the top, they can eat that. But this grass shreds like this, and that's why Coxfoot and the giant fescues are really important for their habitat. They like nesting above the ground. They're omnivorous. They'll eat seeds, fruit, berries. And at this time of the year, if they get hungry, they'll eat other small rodents, and cannibalistic, they'll eat each other as well if things get bad.
Oh, and they look so sweet.
They
as well,
do,
don't they?
They do.
Butter wouldn't melt.
No, that's right. But I used to do this as a child to show how sharp edge it is. You can get the little grass strip like that, put it between your thumbs, and then I'm trying to do it. Let's have another go, see if I can get it to work. Nearly. That's how sharp the edge
is. It's like the reed in
a
woodwind instrument.
That's right, in a woodwind instrument. So there we are. So if I just part the grass, it's beautiful. The nest won't be used at this time of the year. And it's very distinctive because the female will have got the leaves and shredded them into almost a tennis ball size nest. The hole is always really hard to see. Don't know if we can find the hole. It's in there somewhere. If I get my little index finger in, you can just see the entrance there, quite near the top. And she will have had 4, 5, 6 babies in there. Gestation, they'll start mating in about April onwards, certainly into May, and they can have 4 or 5 litters in a year, as many as that.
And the nest is skillfully woven on this taller grass, and it's sort of suspended 6 inches above the ground.
Yes, and that's their favourite. It's usually halfway up in a clump of grass, and in the summer months it's nigh impossible to find them. I walk down here and look. So as the grass gets battered and it's been hit by lots of rain, and you get sleet, occasional snow, and it bashes the grass down and exposes the nests, which are kind of built through the grass stems. You can see the nest is completely with a 1 or 2 grass stems right through the middle of it. So there we are. Tiny territories, so you can have 6 or 7 pairs down this margin, probably 40, 50 square metres, something like that, as small as that.
And that is their world.
And that's their entire world. And so we don't come on here with tractors. Occasionally it's mown once every 3 years. So there we are.
Back in the farmyard now, and we're heading towards your home here, Chris. Does that mean I'm going to be allowed inside out of the rain?
I think I might make us both a coffee. We've been suffering for our art form this morning, and so I think we'll, as long as you trust me with my cooking abilities, in we go. This is heaven. It's the name of my house. I didn't name it. The builders and the plasterers sat on this step and had a panoramic view of Norwich in front of us. And the sun was shining and looked over all the woodland here. And more than one person, including the electrician who wired it all out for me, said, "This is heaven." And that's how it got its name.
I'll take these shoes off because they're a bit muddy.
Yes.
And you'll see now I've got odd socks.
I'm not having you. So you have. How odd. Right, I'm just going to put the kettle on.
Oh, that's a lovely cup of tea, Chris.
Excellent.
Well done.
Thank you very much. Yes.
I think we've found your talent now.
Yes. I had a nickname. I used to do cooking years ago and still do. And it was called Alfred back then. Because so, King Alfred sort of burnt the cakes, didn't he? And there we are. But anyway, I've improved a lot since then. So I've got a coffee, you've got a cup of tea. And we're sitting in my living room. There's a big fireplace here with a log burner going and 2 little fans on top of the log burner, which power themselves. Very clever, and it's throwing the warm air out. And I designed the chimney stack when the builders were building it. About 12 bags of vermiculite insulation arrived to put round the chimney to insulate the whole chimney stack, because it's about 8 feet wide, big beam over the top. And I said, "What are you doing with that?" He said, "We're going to insulate your chimney." And I said, "No, you're not. You're going to fill that with concrete." And they looked at me. and shrugged their shoulders. Well, whatever. He said, you're paying. So the whole of that in there is solid concrete. And that log burner heats up that concrete as the heat goes up the chimney. And 2 days later, you put your hand on the chimney breast, it's still warm. And it's like a huge night storage radiator. Learned about those because my father bought some for the farmhouse, two downstairs. And they had big concrete blocks in there with air in the concrete. And that used to last during the daylight. So I copied that. And then you'll see a little fan above the ceiling here because the ceilings are quite high. They're about 8 feet up. And I can turn a little switch on in my kitchen and take the warm air out of here and transfer it through into the kitchen.
So these are the benefits of designing stuff your own yourself. Home from
yes,
home,
yes,
especially for your needs.
Yes, hope you enjoy our little visit for winter flowers this week. And we're finishing off in the warmth, and it's an absolute delight to share the countryside at this time of year.
I know you're busy on the farm, so you can get off, do what you need to do, and I'll just stay here in front of the fire.
You want another cup of tea then?
Oh, yes. And any biscuits?
Oh, no, that's pushing the boat out.
This is a Soundyard production. Music is by Tom Harris. And that's where we'll leave Matthew and Chris, cosy by the fire with hot tea in hand. Catch you again in a month's time for more adventures at High Ash Farm. Remember, if you'd like to listen to the podcast in full, then you can head to www.countrysidepodcast.co.uk.